I'm paying you homage. Yeah.
Music from Ginger Milliman, Fountain of Life. Word from Joel Henson and Sarah Groves, Traveling Light. And good morning to you now, 7 minutes after the hour. Doug Greenwald joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good morning to you and happy Wednesday.
Morning, guys. How are things morning. In the great state of
East Dakota? Well, let's see. It's zero. It's partly cloudy. We're headed to way below zero tonight. Wind chills to 45 below. So it's pretty close to spring, the way it looks.
I have a great idea to get national TV coverage for East Dakota.
Oh, yeah.
Assuming we would want that.
Just might, but here it is. Given the nature of this winter, you could have an ice fishing contest on the 4th of July.
Yeah. We'd go catch ice is what we'd do.
There is an ice fishing contest in the area, in the neighborhood, that draws people from around the world. There are people from Germany who charter planes to come and do this ice fishing contest. They had 150,000 people out on the ice fishing for walleye. Just like,
The basic thing is somebody has to drill all those holes for them ahead of time. You know?
Oh, man.
Make Swiss cheese out of that lake.
Mm-hmm. Takes about 3 days to drill all the holes. Mm-hmm. You've got a team of guys that go out there. Well, it's some girls now, but a team of guys go out there with power augers, and they're out there for days.
Yeah, we just drill it. It's just such traffic congestion. Just stay away from that thing whenever that happens every January.
Oh,
silly just people who go out there and sit on the ice and pretend they're fishing.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
We're fishing for that woman at the well story, Doug. We've been at this now for, 3 weeks? And we're halfway through chapter 2. I got to tell you, the journey is fun. I'm learning a lot. You're opening some eyes here, I think.
And did you guys take your Ritalin this morning so you're not so impatient?
I'm not impatient. I'm eager. There's a difference. There's eagerness and there's impatience. This is eagerness.
Well, you're right. We're somewhere in John 2. I think we sort of ended up talking about social reciprocity and the whole underlying nature of what's known as a social contract when it comes to these wedding feasts, these multi-day wedding feasts. Many of the people who would be coming to the feast that Jesus is attending with his disciples in John 2 would have gone to many preceding wedding feasts. In fact, the host of this particular wedding feast probably went to dozens of wedding feasts in Cana. And so there's an implied contract in place here. If I fed you all you can eat, and if I allowed you to drink all the wine that you wanted to drink, we have a social contract here. You must do the same for me. Mandatory social reciprocity, mandatory hospitality. And if you don't, you are shamed. And shame is a big deal in this Middle Eastern culture, honor and shame. It's probably something that the host family would never, ever get over. The couple that's just been married and is celebrating their wedding would live with this motif, this cloud of shame over their lives for the rest of their days, as well as their children's children. Things don't get forgotten fast in the Middle Eastern villages. So there's a lot of things at risk here when they are on the verge of running out of wine.
And you told us last week, too, that probably Jesus and Mary, their family, was probably good friends, certainly closely acquainted with these people hosting the party, having been through Cana many times between Capernaum and Nazareth. So that suggests, well, I'll just let you tell this, because I'm thinking there's some pressure on Mother Mary here.
Well, we don't know the exact relationship. They could be extended clan, so we're dealing with a cousin situation here. But Mary is there, and Jesus is there, and he is allowed to bring his disciples with him. So certainly Jesus and by Mary, by extension, is viewed with some prominence in this situation. Another piece of context that we need to drop in place here is that in the Hebrew worldview, in the Hebrew mind, wine is the symbol of joy. And this is a wedding feast that is about to run out of joy. In fact, there's a greater backdrop here as well. this narrative that John is painting for us is telling us that joy has basically left Israel. There is no joy in the religious protocols, mechanical activities that take place in and around the temple, the high priest, the Sanhedrin, the Jerusalem Pharisees, etc., etc. So that's part of the backdrop here. A joyless nation on the verge of a joyless wedding party. Now, did we talk about ritual purification and those water vessels last week?
Yes, the living water and the procedure that a servant would follow as a guest arrived. Yeah, but it's okay. worth a review, because that's really significant. In fact, that to me that presages what goes on at the well later on in John.
It does that as well, and it also sets up a more deeper understanding of the miracle that Jesus performs here, is that these ritual purification jars, and we're given great specificity here. There are 15 or 20 gallons a capacity each, and there are five of them. They are meant to make each person ritually pure, ritually clean when they enter the room here where the wedding feast is taking place. And so what the servants will do is ladle out some water and pour it over your hands, and there'll be a basin underneath your hands to collect the water. And it's important that that's done that way, because the water is moving, obviously, by gravity. It's moving from above your hands, across your hands, and then it leaves your hands and collects itself in the bowl. And because it's moving, and the technical term for that is living water, it can carry away your impurities. And all throughout Israel, there are ritual purification baths. One of the things I think that people don't really appreciate until you go to Israel and start nosing around is the phenomenal and creative hydraulic systems, civil engineering of water, so that water is always moving, always flowing in these ritual purification baths. There are some 32 ritual purification baths called mikveh or mikvot in the plural that have been found around Temple Mount so far. And if you've ever been to Israel, water is not easy to come by. Sometimes they have to aqueduct it in for miles and miles away. And so this is what's going on. Excuse me, I had to sneeze there for some reason. Yeah. Mm. This is what's going on all throughout the country at the local synagogues, where they have their ritual purification baths. And the symbolism, the meaning of that, is picked up here in these ceremonial containers, these stone vessels that are used for ritual purification. So that's going to factor in just a moment here. Now, I wanted you guys to do a little mathematics for me here.
Okay.
If I've got five 15 to 20 gallon vessels, and Jesus tells the servants to top them off with water, how many gallons of water do I now have in those topped off five vessels?
75 to 100.
Okay. And if I'm got 4 quarts to the gallon, how many quarts do I have?
Before, that's 300 to 400 quarts.
Yeah, and if I factor it down a little bit for 750 mLs, which is the size of the wine bottles.
Oh, now I got to convert to milliliters, Doug.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You guys skipped school when it was metrics Tuesday?
Liter is a little smaller than a quart.
We had our metrics Thursday, Dave. And there was nobody showed up.
Well, let's just roll this around to about 500 bottles.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Ever been to a wedding feast where the whole rolls out toward the end of the feast 500 of the finest bottles of wine?
Not that I can recall. No, I don't think I've seen
well,
that.
Well, and I think that's the key phrase, not that he can recall. And I don't recall it either, because we've already drunk the cheap wine, and so we don't recall much of anything. I guess I don't mean to get ahead.
Well,
of the
now
game
let's
here.
Be fair to these people, Doug, because these weddings were not an afternoon affair, was it? These went on for days sometimes.
Yeah, these are several days long. Yeah. But stunning, remarkable 500 bottles of wine rolled out near the end of the wedding feast. Now, what fascinates me when you read a lot of the commentaries, there's a certain denominational persuasion, I won't name them, but it starts with B, that just can't deal with the fact that Jesus created 500 bottles of wine. Mm-hmm. It's too excessive. It's way beyond the pale.
Would it help to say it's 20 cases? would that help them?
See, that's where your Western culture just gets in the way.
No.
And I think that's the whole point here. This is excessive. The joy of heaven is going to overflow. It is meant to be excessive. It is meant to be enormous. It is meant to be profound. All right? So that's just some more dots here in this story. But what really gets fascinating was how commentators have tried to deal with Jesus' interaction with his mother. So Jesus comes. Some have seen it as a put-down. When he says, basically, what's that to you and me? Why do we even bring that up? What's that to me?
So Jesus putting down his mother was the way that some interpreted that?
Some commentators actually see it that way.
Okay.
Some see it as Jesus now declaring his independence from her, because now he's 30 years of age and he has launched his ministry. How do we know he has launched his ministry? Because he has disciples with them. But I think people miss here, and that's why I wanted to spend some time about social reciprocity. Obviously, these are friends of Mary and Jesus. And Jesus has stayed there before. There's all signs point to that. Therefore, in the context of mandatory social reciprocity, if they have done something good for Jesus, he is mandated to do something good for them. And I think Mary is simply reminding Jesus here of our social obligation.
You know what I think? Then this is the picture that always comes to mind when I read that. Mary spotted Jesus across the room. She knew the wine situation. She walked over to him, grabbed him by the earlobe, pulled him over to the side of the room and said, "Jesus, you got to do something about this. We owe these people big time. Take care of it, will you?"
I think that's an exaggeration. I don't think she has to exaggerate anything. She simply has to give Jesus an FYI. Mm-hmm. For your information, they're about to run out of wine. Mm-hmm. Between the lines here, these are our friends.
But, you know, this was the first miracle that we've seen from Jesus. So did Mary expect a miracle, do you suppose?
Well, let me ask the question like a rabbi would in reverse. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't she expect a miracle from Jesus? She remembers the night he was born.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she remembers the whole deal.
The prophecies from in the temple.
Mm-hmm. So this would have been a natural thing for her to expect.
Yeah, this has become a normal way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows he's announced his ministry because he's got disciples. So just maybe this is the time for him to do something spectacular. Mm-hmm. The launch is obvious ministry.
Yeah, but he's hesitant.
I'm sorry?
He is hesitant to do that, though,
is
judging
he?
From his response. Or did he say that with a wink? That, you know, I wish
see,
we had
the body.
See,
there we are again. How do you discern tongue-in-cheekism in the scriptures? How do you see the smile on Jesus' face or the frown when he says something?
Mm-hmm.
Only context gives us hints into that. I would suspect that Jesus' smirk isn't the quite word, but a gentle smile on his face, maybe a nodding ahead. Yeah, what's that of me? Mm-hmm. I got the message. I know what you're saying.
Just a slight grin on his voice as he says, "Any particular vintage?"
Yeah. And remind me again, how big are those vessels? Mm-hmm. Of course, he probably knew. Yeah. So I would suggest to you that the context here of social reciprocity is probably the best way to understand this somewhat puzzling interaction for some commentators, many commentators actually, who don't think about this notion of tongue-in-cheekism of Jesus. Remember when we did Luke 11 and the parable of the visitor at midnight?
Yes.
That whole thing is tongue-in-cheek.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been hard for us to see here in the West. I mean, I've never seen it that way until you explained it.
And I would suggest that's probably what's going on here as well. But let's bear down here a little bit more, bore down. He converts water, which is intended for ritual purification. And because it's ritual purification, you have to purify yourself time and time and time again. It's a very repetitive process. And Jesus converts it into wine, the symbol of his blood.
Now, would people have known that at the time, or would his disciples have known that at the time?
No. Okay. But that's why John says this is a sign. Mm-hmm. This is pointing ahead to the shedding of his blood, which will obsolete the need for ritual purification to get purified over and over and over again, because his blood is sufficient to cleanse you once and for all.
Now, do you suppose that this was red wine?
Do you mean wine with alcohol in it?
Well, I mean, no, I'm sure it was. It was wine. It doesn't say he changed water into Kool-Aid. It says water into wine. But was it red wine? Isn't that what they routinely made, a sweet red wine back then in that place?
I've never gone down that road. So I mean,
just think of the resemblance to blood then.
Yeah, and we have to also bring in here the reference to wine is the symbol of joy.
Mm-hmm.
So the joy that comes knowing that you have been purified once and for all. So there's a lot going on here. This is already pointing towards the cross, this very first miracle here.
And then this would have been something that in later months and years, the disciples would look back at and go, oh, wow. We didn't know at the time, but look what we were being taught.
You know, we only get glimpses of that in Acts from time to time, but I'll bet these disciples further down the road had moment after moment of ahas when they looked through the rearview mirror of what happened and said, now I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I see how the dots connect. And there's a certain sense that's true for even our own lives. The further we get down the road, the more time and distance we have through the rearview mirror, and we can see how the events in our lives were connected, how they were orchestrated, how the Lord was there even when we didn't know it, feel it, or see it, and how he is working all things together for good. And so I think we can relate a little bit to them. But let's get back to the party here. I want you to be a servant. You're in the back room, and let's just say in a kitchen, with Jesus, and he said to you, go get a bunch of water, top off those wine vessels, or those water vessels. Fine, did that. Now I want you to dip a ladle in there, and I want you to take it direct to the host and the master of ceremonies. Have him sample what you just drew out of this 15, 20-gallon stone vessel. You have no idea what that liquid has become. You don't know whether it's good or bad. It's kind of risky. What if it turns out that the host doesn't like it? What if it turns out it's a bitter fluid? There you are, caught right in the middle of this thing. So it's kind of interesting here. The servants who followed Jesus' directions didn't know at the moment they were commanded to do something how this thing was going to turn out.
Want a small detour?
Or a big cul-de-sac. Yeah,
It'll be a cul-de-sac because we'll come right back to it. Even now, as you go into a restaurant where you buy wine with a cork in the bottle, appropriate wine etiquette will have the host or maybe even the sommelier bring the bottle over to the table of the person who bought the wine, uncork it, and pour him a small amount in the bottom of his glass for his approval first, before serving the rest of the table.
Oh, right.
Okay, we can go back to the street now. I think that there is something in that tradition that either stemmed from what we're talking about here or has always been that way, that the host is the one who samples the wine to make sure it's good. Interesting. Okay,
yeah,
we can go back.
Thank you.
We can turn around now and we can go back to where we were.
So it's interesting the way John puts this in the 11th verse of the second chapter, that Jesus gave this first sign through which he revealed his glory. Now, the Hebrew understanding of glory is to reveal and accurately portray, okay? Through this first sign, Jesus revealed and accurately portrayed what he was going to do. He was going to shed his blood for the remission of many.
You know, that definition of glory needs to be put on a sign somewhere in every church.
We all think radiant Shekinah glory, yeah. And we miss it. I mean, that's another use of glory when we're talking about the intrinsic manifestation of the holiness of God. But here it's being used to reveal and portray. Jesus reveals and portrays God. He glorifies God. And here he glorifies himself in the sense that he is revealing through the symbolism of this sign what he has come to do and what he will do.
I'm writing this down.
Interesting. Very interesting. But one more time, I want my money back from my Sunday school teachers. That would have been an interesting little subtext, a little content that would have meant, you know, more meaning. It wasn't just a magic trick. It was actually, it actually meant something.
Yeah, Doug, every time you come on, we latch on to something here that just just launches us ahead in the right direction. It's just a good experience.
Now, let's finish this up.
Yeah.
I want you now to be the host family. I want you to be the maitre d'. All of a sudden, you were on the edge of disaster and you didn't even know it. And now you have set the highest standard, the highest bar for a wedding feast ever in the history of this village. Whoever would have brought out 500 bottles of their finest wine in the latter stages of a wedding feast? What a remarkable family. What a remarkable host. This young couple who just got married will never be forgotten, but for a very good reason now, not because of shame, but because of incredible honor that has been brought upon their family. They have done something that no family has ever done, has ever heard of, and that will never be forgotten for the rest of their lives. Isn't that a remarkable reversal?
Alert the media.
Yep.
I mean, if there was newspapers at the time, they'd be camping. They'd be, satellite trucks outside their house by the end of the day.
So, do you suppose this was a big story in Cana?
Oh yes, absolutely. And I feel sorry for everyone else who's going to get married after this couple. You can never measure up to this wedding feast.
Keep up with the Greenbergs there.
Established that no one can ever reach.
But Daddy, I want a wedding like they had. I just went to a wedding a couple of weeks ago. My wife's niece got married, and yeah, there was just examples of just obvious excess for no particular reason that somebody else had something that was not quite as good, but this is much better. This is much bigger. This is much, much nicer, within reason, of course, but just, all kinds of examples of that. And, I could just see the girl saying to her dad, he said, "But Dad, you divorced Mom. You owe me this. I want this. This is even better," and all the rest of it.
And Doug, this family in Cana must have been well-to-do, because this was a big wedding. This was not...
Yeah, it is. And with five ritual purification vessels, that must have been a pretty big spread, pretty big house.
So the social obligation would have been increased for them, really.
Enormous. It's probably an insula home, a multi-room home. That's a whole other topic, but yes. But let's just end up with this. Let's try to personalize this. Again, this family was on the edge of a disaster and didn't know it. And now they are the talk of the town. They were rescued and they didn't even know it. Do you think those same outcomes can be said of our own lives?
Yes.
We were on the edge of disasters at certain moments in our past and didn't even know it. And we were rescued and had some good things happen. So it might be interesting, in a time of meditation, to ask the Holy Spirit, to reflect back on our lives, when were there some times when we really missed how much we should have been rejoicing?
Or simply thankful for being for having disaster averted.
You know, it reminds me of Mr. Magoo. Now, most of, maybe depending on the age of your listening audience, they'll relate to this or not. But the guy is going through life with disasters falling all around him, right? Remember Mr. Magoo from the cartoons?
Yep, I do.
And he's completely oblivious to it. And sometimes I think that, you know, it may be a weak metaphor, but there's certainly some truisms there that extend to our each of our lives as well. We have been protected. We have had a hedge around us at moments in time in the past that protected us for something that we didn't even know was about to befall us, and it never did.
Well, it's actually a very, very apropos allegory, because Mr. Magoo was nearsighted. He saw the things that were right in front of him and not beyond. And, and that led to all kinds of misadventures. And the same applies to our life, I think. We just don't see the big picture very often. But you help us do that, and we're grateful for that. Anywhere else we should go today? We got a few minutes left.
Well, I just want to observe that yesterday and today I've been working on John 3, Nicodemus. Mm. So I think that's where we're going to be next week.
Okay.
And let's just put the big picture in place here. The reason we dropped in on John 1 is because John said, when you see Jesus, you see God. And we talked about the implications of that. Because when we get to John 4 and see Jesus at work with the Samaritan woman, we're seeing God at work with the Samaritan woman. We want to drop in on Cana because this is a nation who's lost its joy. Well, maybe it's time to take the joys to some other peoples, like the Samaritans, okay? And next week, we're going to drop in on a person who I'm going to describe as the creme de la creme of Jewish religious culture of the first century, a Jew's Jew, Nicodemus. If anyone would get it, what Jesus is about, it's him, and we'll sort of dive into how Jesus interacts with him and how Nicodemus responds. And then when we've done that, we're ready to start to jump into John 4.
Well, and I'm looking forward to that. And David, I'm sure you are too. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. It's a ministry. Go ahead.
Far be it from me to disagree with my partner, the creator of the radio station and the host of this station.
That'd be me.
I'm enjoying the ride. I'm not necessarily looking forward to getting to John 4 because, well, I know that there's going to be more journey after that. But this circuitous route to get to the fourth book of John has been absolutely pleasurable. I think I'm just having a great time.
Well,
so take your time.
We're thankful to Doug. Yep.
Well, we could actually call it contextually linear too, as opposed to circuitous.
Yeah. Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times has a website. It's preservingbibletimes.org, and you can link to them from our website, and you can listen to any of, well, probably what, 200 broadcasts with Doug in our podcast archive. And you can download them, listen to them at your convenience, or just kind of trace some of the routes we've taken, some of the old other cul-de-sacs we've stumbled upon over the past 2.5 years. It's a delight to have you, Doug, and be blessed. We'll look forward to next Wednesday, okay?
Thanks. And here's a thought for you. Mm-hmm. You know, after Nicodemus, maybe we should suspend John for a bit and do a 3 or 4 week Lenten series.
Hey, that's not a bad idea. It's that time. It is.
Yep.
Doug, take care. We'll see you next week.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Yep. Music continues on our Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning together.